Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Junk Science and the American Justice System.
As to the sole count of the indictment, murder in the second degree, how do you find?
As to the sole count of the indictment, we find the defendant guilty.
Why do folks like true crime stories and all their manifestations so much? I have been told it's not the gore or the unraveling of the mystery. In the end, it comes down to one thing: the perp getting his or her just desserts and going to prison or being executed. But what if that resolution relied on junk science to obtain that outcome? Those of us addicted to Law and Order, or CSI, love our forensic experts. But what if all or most of their work has little or no basis in actual verifiable science? Voice prints, bite marks, hair analysis, garbage bag creases, blood spatter, burn path, fingerprints, face recognition, ballistics, footprints, handwriting analysis, and hypnosis are just a few. Yes, even fingerprint analysis is far from perfect. To explain it all to us is Innocence Project attorney and author M. Chris Fabricant. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we dig into it, let's talk a little bit about the Innocence Project, where it is, how big it is, what its history and goals are.
So the Innocence Project is actually celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, or actually in 2022, we celebrated our 30th anniversary. Now it's 2023. But, you know, I think that the best way to really look at the impact of the Innocence Project's work on the criminal legal system in the United States is to think about what it was like before the Innocence Project came on the scene and forensic DNA testing became a thing that the American public is now and the American justice system is familiar with. Is that before that time, really, jury verdicts were thought to be essentially infallible. You know, notable wrongful convictions had happened in history, but it was thought to be a vanishingly rare occurrence. And that with all of the protections that our system provides in terms of your right to remain silent and the right to counsel and jury trials and the right to confront witnesses against you, that wrongful conviction was really, really unlikely. And the evidence that we use to convict people of crimes, things like eyewitness identification and forensic sciences and confessions, were thought to be very reliable evidence. And then two lawyers, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, harnessed the nascent technology of DNA evidence, first, you know, used disastrously in the O.J. Simpson trial, and then later used to help free the innocent. So Barry and Peter understood the power of forensic DNA to not only to convict people, but also to free the innocent. And as a result, and really this is a result of the intake criteria of the Innocence Project when they first started, And what was really important about that was that there were no efforts made to make subjective judgments about guilt or innocence. The only criteria to take on a new case was if we could find DNA evidence, biological evidence, and test that evidence, would that prove innocence? And if so, we would take the case. And as a result, we learned, you know, we took cases with six eyewitnesses, all pointing to our clients and saying, that's the guy, I'll never forget that face. And they were all wrong. As a result, we knew all these forensic sciences, fingerprints, bite marks, hair microscopy, tire treads, dog scent evidence, ballistics evidence, you name it. This was all, 50% of all wrongful convictions are attributable, at least in part, to the misuse of forensic sciences. We knew that people confessed in great detail to crimes that they had not committed, including apologizing to victims. So you really couldn't understate the influence of the Innocence Project and similar organizations around the country at disrupting the status quo as it relates to the legal system. And the status quo has really been fighting back ever since.
One of the walls that defense attorneys come up against when trying to get a new trial based on new evidence is the theory or the principle of finality. Why don't you explain for us the principle of finality?
Who, despite having incarcerated innocent people for decades, refused to get DNA testing that would know and expose ground truth, that we would know whether or not an innocent person was in prison, and prosecutors successfully arguing in court, pointing to the principle of finality, that the defendant is not entitled and that society is not entitled to know the truth, which was always astonishing to me when I started working at the Innocence Project, that how could you be afraid of the truth? How would you not want to know the ground truth of actually what happened? Now, I had spent, a decade as a public defender and would understand that that's much more, an adversarial process, and even though I did not appreciate often my adversary's positions, at least in that role, my job was to defend everybody who came in the front door. Now, at the Innocence Project, when we're trying to prove innocence and we have evidence that we could all agree would demonstrate that, I just don't understand, could not understand why you wouldn't want that and why that wouldn't be so. And so what I really tried to do, when you talk about shows with CSI and Law and Order, which I enjoy too, and criminal procedurals have been around since, Quincy. And in all of those shows, every single one of those shows, think back to any time that you've watched over the last decades, this popular culture, criminal procedurals, where any of the forensic were wrong, or even unreliable, or somewhat shaky. No, they're objective, they're conclusive, they get it done in an hour. The forensic scientists, in air quotes, are heroes, and the case is wrapped up. There is no skepticism because science sells. That's why we use it, right? Apart from sex, scientifically tested is probably the line that you hear more advertisements than any. And so when I wrote Junk Science, the goal really was to change this popular narrative and popular culture narrative around the infallibility of forensics, told through the lens of my innocent clients, how hard it was to overturn those convictions, pointing to the principle of finality, but also the real life human beings whose lives were destroyed.
Some would say, well, you're a free man. I will never be free of this. There's no possibility. Excuse me if I get emotional. That I spent more than half my life in prison behind the opinions and the expert egos of two odontologists. There's a death penalty case in Pennsylvania that's going on now, and the judge is going to allow bite mark evidence. How many people have to be wrongly convicted before they realize that this stuff's all bogus? It's all made up.
So, Chris, let's move from general concepts in Junk Science and talk about some of the, you have several, but pick a few of the most egregious cases that either you or the Innocence Project worked on.
The Keith Harward story, the Stephen Mark Cheney story, and the Eddie Lee Howard story. And all three of those represent different things that you were pointing out right at the beginning of the podcast, right? So the beginning is really all the power of Junk Science to convict the innocents, and that's Keith Howard, right? And the power of DNA to prove innocence. Now, and Stephen Mark Cheney, you can look at a science that's based almost entirely on junk science, a conviction, I mean, that's based almost entirely on junk science, but we don't have conclusive DNA evidence in that, and all the reforms that had to go into freeing him. And then you have Eddie Lee Howard, which is much more of a traditional criminal legal system case because it's overt racism, a Mississippi case, where a black man was wrongfully accused and convicted and sent to Parchman's death row for the rape and murder of an elderly white woman, based on nothing but invented science by a villainous forensic odontologist named Michael West, who's now notorious. So those are the three kind of backbone stories of junk science. And those are the stories that I want to offer as a counter narrative, a counterfactual to shows like CSI. You know, the Tommy Lee Walker story is devastating. It's a lynching dressed up like a criminal proceeding in 1950s Dallas. Last week, in fact, I met Tommy Lee Walker's son for the first time. And this podcast is actually the first time I've talked about it publicly. And his son grew up until maybe his teens, you know, had been told that his father had been electrocuted, and he believed that it had been some sort of industrial accident, didn't understand that the state of Texas had murdered him. And, you know, we're going to try to reinvestigate his case. What happened with Tommy Lee Walker was that in 1952 Dallas, there was a so-called, you can't see my fingers, you know, a Negro prowler scare. And in white Dallas, there was a total panic about, you know, the old racist trope of hypersexualized black men were lurking in windows and exposing themselves to white women. And so groups of vigilante white men with shotgun wielding roamed the streets looking for, you know, naked black men. There was never anybody caught. It was just this mass hysteria that went on for nearly a year in Dallas. And then a woman named Dorothy Parker was murdered near the Dallas airport. Her throat was cut and appeared that she may have been sexually assaulted, but that was never shown. And at the time of that murder, Tommy Lee Walker was witnessing the birth of his son, the same son that I spoke to last week. But, and I think it was 9 alibi witnesses testified at his trial, but, you know, he got picked up with zero suspicion, no eyewitnesses. The police are simply going down a list of former employees of a gas station that had been robbed, and arresting and questioning anybody black that, you know, is somehow a potential suspect for, you know, this murder. Then Henry Wade, who I write a fair amount about, who's the same prosecutor who prosecutor's office who wrongfully convicted Stephen Marchini. He was early in his career. He was a district attorney in Dallas, one of the most notorious district attorneys in American history. He was the Wade in Roe v. Wade, and he prosecuted Jack Ruby. And his partner in law enforcement was Captain Will Fritz, who is notorious for eliciting confessions. And he elicited a confession from Tommy Lee Walker the night of his arrest after slow walking him past two prison guards who were beating another black man in a jail cell. And then, you know, got a confession that claimed that, you know, that the victim had run into his knife while he was, you know, attempting to rob her. And the which is inconsistent with the injuries that, which was a slash across the throat of the woman who had died, which would have made both implausible with the facts and also the claim by police that she had, with her dying words, that a big Negro had taken her under the bridge and killed her, when all of the evidence suggested she would not have been able to speak at all. And Tommy Lee Walker's, you know, so-called confession being inconsistent with the objective facts is one of the factors that we now know as a result of the Innocence Project and other or similar organizations' work that is indicative of a unreliable confession, right? If the facts don't match up to what the supposed confession was, it suggests that the confessor doesn't really know the facts. Cameron Todd Willingham had no significant criminal history. You know, he was just kind of a regular blue collar guy. His, you know, and a working class, and lived in a working class neighborhood. And one morning, as a result of what we came to believe later was faulty wiring, his house caught on fire and burned to the ground in a matter of minutes, killing all three of his young daughters. His wife was actually at the Salvation Army shopping for Christmas presents for their children. I think it was December 23rd, right before Christmas. Witnesses on the scene described him as hysterical and that he had to be chained to a bumper to prevent him from running back in the house to save his children. And then what happened was, and this is true with a lot of forensics, is that subsequently fire investigators went into the apartment armed with the folklore of arson investigators that had been passed down through generations. And this folklore told these investigators to look for certain signs within the house to determine whether or not this was a deliberately set fire or an accident. So what happened was that these signs, which are intuitive, like a lot of junk science, it appeals to your intuition. You know, it just hasn't been tested. So there's no way to know if this is just speculation or actual empirical knowledge. And they looked for things like multiple points of origin, right? Which suggests that a deliberately set fire, it will be set in more than one place. They look for things like pore patterns on the floor, which is kind of looks like a burn pattern that suggests that something like lighter fluid or gasoline was spread on the floor and lit on fire because it looks like a fire that would have tracked that path. And then they looked at things like crazed glass. That was glass that had shattered in this crazed way as a result of intense heat from the fire. And it was believed that fires set with accelerants like lighter fluids or gas burned hotter and the glass would do that. So all of those signs were there in Cameron Todd Willingham's house. These fire investigators decided that it was arson. And less than a year later, Cameron Todd Willingham was convicted and sentenced to death for the triple homicide of his children. And ultimately, he was put to death. And, you know, what I write about, you know, in the scene is the efforts that had gone on before his execution to give the evidence to Governor Rick Perry of Texas that the science had been debunked. Gerald Hurst, who is a very, very formative Cambridge-educated chemist, had written an affidavit showing that this was bogus, and nonetheless, the execution went forward. Then the Texas Forensic Science Commission was going to issue a report showing that the science had been debunked right before Governor Perry was running for his third term in Texas. Governor Perry, right before the report was going to be issued, fired the most of the board members and prevented the publication of that report before his unprecedented third term, slow rolled the investigation so it didn't affect his political prospects. But any fair reading of the facts of the Cameron Todd Willingham case demonstrates an innocent person was executed. The only motive that was attributed to him was, you know, that the having children interfered with his beer drinking and dart throwing lifestyle. And what I did in the book is compare it to one of his fellow prisoners on death row in Texas that had essentially the precise same facts based on the precise same evidence, but he had Latham and Watkins fighting for his innocence on appeal and were willing to put in $1 million, you know, in his defense to demonstrate that this person was innocent. So really, Cameron Todd Willingham went to death row, virtually the same facts. Another prisoner that he was in prison with was freed and is free today. So, you know, this is the power of junk science, not just to convict the innocents, but also to execute the innocent. You know, and this is why, you know, I devote a little bit of time in the book to talking about capital punishment as it relates to the innocence movement and the role that junk science has played in this.
The Law & Order SVU episode entitled Torch was loosely based on Mr. Willingham's case, but the ending was quite different. The ADA, played by Sharon Stone, doubted the testimony of her own witness, the fire marshal. She ignored DA Jack McCoy's directive to convict the father and hired her own expert and staged the burning of a derelict house, tricked out with cameras, etc., to prove the arrogant fire marshal wrong. The following is the PowerPoint presentation to the jury.
The fire was set in a condemned house, structurally identical to the Sullivans' home, recreated with the exact same furnishings.
Right. Everything's the same, so the fire burns just like it did the first time. You could have saved a lot of time and money by just reading my report.
And how long did it take for the fire to consume the entire house?
A little over 2 minutes.
In 2 minutes' time, Faye and Kenzie Sullivan went from being sound asleep to trapped inside an inescapable inferno.
It's called an accelerant for a reason, and somebody did manage to escape, and he's sitting right over there.
And this fire will tell us if he's guilty.
That's right.
What are we looking at here on the floor and on the walls?
The same puddled patterns, burn patterns, and spidered glass that I described in my report on the Sullivan House fire.
On the right, are these the burn patterns in the Sullivan home?
Yep. Like I said, they're identical.
And only an accelerant can cause those burn patterns?
Correct.
And you are absolutely sure of that?
As sure as I'm sitting here right now.
Yet no accelerant was used to start that fire.
What the hell are you talking about?
Watch. Maybe you'll learn something.
This fire will be started by shorting out these two wires in the space heater beside the bed. No accelerant is being used anywhere in the house.
That's impossible.
Impossible that it happened? Or impossible that you were wrong?
I know what I saw.
And we know what we just saw. The exact same fire caused by an electrical short circuit, not by arson. And this is an animation of the recreation of the fire, with Frank Sullivan's actions exactly as he described them to Dr. Drexel.
An electrical short circuit starts the fire. The girls cry out, waking Frank, who runs to their room. Unable to break down the door, he runs down the stairs, out of the house, opening the front door, and the sudden rush of fresh air causes the flashover.
You testified that those spots were caused by an accelerant. These exact same spots in the recreation were caused by a fire that started in those girls' bedroom, not arson. That is the danger of junk science. That's a match.
We got a match.
And they just found us a match.
Visible match.
We have a match.
Match.
Were you able to determine which monkey bit him?
The bite marks matched those of the monkey found at the scene.
Now, Chris, you spent a good portion of your book on bite mark junk science, hence the cover, very clever cover with the money through the choppers. And it is, of course, the graphic is the thumbnail for the podcast. Anyway, so you did this with good reason. So let's delve into the junk science of bite mark evidence.
But I talk about the first case where bite mark evidence was introduced in American criminal courts. And then I was able to kind of trace the history of, like, how did we even get to that first case? And what was going on was that the forensic dentists, their forensic odontologist, had been around for a long time and kind of on the adjacent to a forensics or on the periphery of forensics, because what they were doing was that the medical examiner's office, they were identifying dead bodies. Sure, most people have heard of human remains being identified through their dental records. Bodies burned beyond recognition through their dental records. Most people don't know who it is that's actually doing that. It's your favorite, you know, friendly neighborhood forensic dentist. And that's righteous work. And it's worth doing. I mean, and gives closure to families and, you know, to identify bodies. And it's cheaper than DNA testing. But so that work had been going on with, you know, in forensic pathology shops, but they weren't becoming expert witnesses. They weren't crime solvers. They weren't Quincy. They weren't getting paid as expert witnesses. But they were there and they wanted in on that action. You know, and I talk about the explosion of the expert witness industry in the book, both in the civil and the criminal side. And shows like Quincy and the development of the FBI lab had created this a new industry that was seemed exciting and crime solving and law and ordery. And it was very appealing to, you know, particularly young men in that era to go into this field. So the dentists had started, you know, pointing to bite mark evidence. You know, and so they were seeing things, injuries on cadavers, you know, I mean, at the morgue and at the medical examiner's office that they thought looked like bite marks. And what's interesting about that and what we actually don't know is that what does a bite mark actually look like, right? And like, how is it that you as a dentist have any expertise in this area or anybody else? And what your listeners are probably thinking is that, well, I remember when my kids were toddlers, they came home from day school, you know what I mean? And I would see big bite marks on them. It's like, Johnny bit me, right? You know what I mean? And that's what it looks like, these perfect teeth, you know, and everything. But that's never the way they look in on a dead body or even an assault victim. In that, in casework, there are diffuse bruises that are really, and I've looked at hundreds and hundreds of these cases, you know, they never look like what you and I have in our mind's eye. But they were looking at this is a potential form of identification, right? So that if we found the teeth that made that mark, we would have who the biter was, and that would be useful for conviction. So it'd be extremely useful because unlike fingerprints or DNA even, there's never an innocent explanation for your bite mark to be on somebody, right? It's felony assault in and of itself. So it was very, very powerful, very prejudicial, you know, because you evidence because you could depict the defendant as an animal, you know, I mean, on top of identifying the person. And so they developed like this idea. And then what was interesting is that the original founding fathers, they called themselves the American Board of Forensic Odontology, and this is a board certification entity that they invented and started giving themselves credentials. And four of them were happened to have law degrees. So they understood the power of precedent and they were looking for the right case. They found this case in California called Walter Marks. He's seemingly an obviously guilty person, although I always reserve judgment with that DNA, you know what I mean? But they didn't, it was a circumstantial case and they really needed some physical evidence. And so they got the first case in, and what was very useful about it was that it was, and forgive the macabre description I'm about to provide, but that the victim's nose had been basically bitten off. And so the bite mark was captured in cartilage, which is a lot different than human skin. Human skin changes hour to hour on a dead body, a decomposing body, right? And day to day, and it's an unpredictable. So a so-called match to a bite mark 1 hour might not match 5 hours later or the next day, right? So whatever kind of matching was being made, you know, was just totally in that moment. But in cartilage, it's a little bit different. So it worked. The court allowed the evidence in for the first time and bite marks, you know, got its foothold in American criminal courts. The conviction was affirmed and that case was cited across the country. And then one of the reasons that I devoted a chapter to the Ted Bundy case is that like, we can see the power of popular culture to drive junk science into the popular imagination and cement it in criminal courts. And Ted Bundy was, you know, probably our most famous serial killer in the United States, responsible for dozens and dozens of murders, and was amongst the first on the FBI's most wanted list, and was what cross-country killing spree. But what a lot of people don't realize is that, and what was interesting to me when I was doing the research on it, was that they really never had any solid evidence against Ted Bundy. There was never any eyewitnesses, except for one person who escaped one time. And, you know, she provided basically a Ken doll type description, and that there was never a hair, there was never fingerprints, anything like that. And so when he was finally arrested in Florida, in the Florida Panhandle, right after the so-called Chi Omega murders, the sheriff who was of Tallahassee was responsible for bringing this indictment, was asked at the first press conference, you know, when are you going to bring the indictment for the Chi Omega murders? He's like, well, we think it's him, right? He was in the neighborhood. This is his MO, you know, I mean, and, you know, the trouble is we don't have any evidence. The only eyewitness in that case saw somebody fleeing, I guess, the sorority under hypnosis, another form of junk science that's used and mentioned a few times in my book, identified, you know, a Chi Omega employee as the person that she saw fleeing. And of course, that was not him. Right. So it was only after Bundy's arrest that they showed him Bundy's photo. Is this the guy? And he's like, oh, yeah, that's the guy. So the what they needed was physical evidence. And he was asked about that. And he said, well, somebody said something about a bite mark, but I don't think that that's very good evidence. And it's really light. You know what I mean? And I don't think we're going to get anywhere with that. But 4 months later, they still didn't have any solid evidence. And so what Sheriff Katarsis had been calling weak and not very usable became Bundy's signature. And then Ted Bundy case was the first nationally televised criminal trial in American history. Bundy himself cross-examined the dentist. The dentist who testified in that case became international celebrities in forensics and went on to convict a bunch of innocent people, including clients of mine that I write in the book. You know what I mean? So you see this power of case law, celebrity, and credentials to create this kind of perfect storm about the way that junk science gets into court, the way it's so hard to dislodge, and the way it can convict the innocent. What I think that, like, the most junk scientists, you know, are not in business trying to convict innocent people. Most are well-intentioned civil servants that have been taught the folklore and have regurgitated what they've taught, you know, I mean, what they've been taught. They aren't familiar with rigorous science because there's no requirements that you have advanced degrees to work in forensics, and that's not their fault. And most of them are very intelligent people that, you know, anybody that has been taught by respected masters of a field, like in a guild-like structure, are going to believe what their teachers tell them, right? And it's accepted in courts and it makes intuitive sense. And so it's very, very hard to tell anybody that who's made their livings and testified as experts in very, very high stakes criminal cases that, you know, that the science isn't there. And then there are people like, you know, Michael West, you know what I mean, who the introduction of this whole forensic odontology field in the legal system allowed somebody like him to flourish. You know, in, you know, Michael West was a Mississippi dentist whose partner in the dark arts of forensics was a guy, a forensic pathologist named Stephen Hain. They're two of the most notorious forensic experts in really in American history. And, you know, I write about one of Dr. West's cases that became, it was, the conviction became, you know, Eddie Lee Howard's death row conviction. And, you know, I was part of his legal team. And, you know, over the years, you know, he had had other wrongful convictions overturned and had become, I guess, eccentric is some of the words, you know, I mean, a nihilist is the way that I described it in the book. And really, you know, capable of saying anything. And, you know, the scene that I think you're referring to is a deposition that I took with him in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is one of the most bizarre, intense, and insane legal experiences I've had in my career, probably the most, which is, you know, why I wrote about it. But the, you know, but we were talking about a death penalty conviction. And, you know, Dr. West was, you know, calling me an ass wipe, you know, and a sociopath, you know what I mean? And really it was an unhinged experience. You know, and, you know, to be clear and to be certain is that I have another client of on death row in Angola prison in Louisiana, who Dr. West's bite mark work is also a part of his case. So the legacy of Dr. West, although it's often spoken about in historical terms, continues to this day. So, and this is true with so many of these, you know, cases, and this, I'm writing an update for the book right now that's going to be into the, in the paperback, and this case will be talked about. But the, so these are, you know, we have new emerging technology that's becoming problematic in its use in the legal system. So this is not a problem that's ending. But we also have, you know, these traditional forensic techniques, and clients are still on death row today and in prison that have put there. And, you know, so much of the work that I do and my colleagues at the Innocence Project do is trying to free people that have been convicted on these, you know, bogus techniques. Now, Eddie Lee Howard's case, you know, I mean, it was really, there was never any evidence of bite marks. You know, like Dr. West testified in front of a capital jury And there was never any photos shown of the alleged bite mark. There was never any, you know, so-called match made. It was just simply oral testimony claiming that three bite marks were found on this victim's body, and all three of them matched Eddie Lee Howard, to Susan, or everybody else on the planet. That's the only evidence that they had to convict him. And it worked twice. So the power of just like somebody being declared an expert and telling a jury that my expertise in this field shows the defendant is guilty is enough. You know what I mean? And so these are the stakes that we're talking about.
The science of bite marks analysis is very accurate.
When it comes to bite marks, Wes considers himself the maestro. He's found bite marks on a decomposed body submerged in a swamp, on a corpse that had been buried for more than a year. He's even used a bite mark taken out of a bologna sandwich to get a conviction.
Now, that sounds impressive, matching a killer's teeth to a bite mark in a bologna sandwich, although you should know that the defendant in that case got a new trial after an autopsy report found that the murder victim had actually eaten a small amount of bologna consistent with the amounts bitten off the sandwich. So that sandwich was irrelevant to the case. In fact, you could even argue that it was actually Dr. West who was full of, say it with me, shit. And that is not the only issue that has arisen from his testimony. There are now five cases where he testified for the prosecution and where the charges were dropped or the conviction was later overturned. And even West himself has admitted that he no longer believes in bite mark analysis for identifying perpetrators, and he doesn't think it should be used in court. And yet, incredibly, every time a defendant has challenged its validity, the court has ruled it admissible. And a key reason for that is that judges often rely on precedent to decide what to allow in front of a jury. So if a particular discipline has been in court before, it is likely that a judge will admit it again. All of which means that, as the co-founder of the Innocence Project points out, decisions about the validity of science are being made by people who don't necessarily know much about it.
Historically, we had a situation where two scientifically illiterate lawyers argued the bona fides of scientific evidence before a scientifically illiterate judge so that 12 scientifically illiterate jurors could decide the weight of that evidence.
And if you think about it, that's absolutely terrifying. Trials can often be a situation where no one really knows what they're doing.
So there was some exculpatory DNA evidence in Eddie Lee Howard's case, and that we argued in the Mississippi Supreme Court that plus the discrediting of bite marks generally, and Dr. West in particular, should have been sufficient to just simply dismiss the indictment and free Eddie Lee Howard from death row. So the Supreme Court did not do that. Instead, it remanded the case back to Columbus, Mississippi, where he'd twice been wrongfully convicted of the same capital murder, for an evidentiary hearing on the issues that we had raised. So these are technically civil proceedings, which gave us the right to depose experts and other witnesses. We had actually wanted to just do the hearing, but and I talk about some of the delays and some of the delay tactics that were used by the AG's office in that case that just dragged it out for years. And so we decided that it made sense for us to take the opportunity to depose their witnesses, because they were claiming that they were going to depose ours, but they never did. It was simply a delay tactic in my mind. And so that's what ended up, you know, me and Tucker Carrington in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, deposing Michael West. And what I wrote about in the book, which I didn't know at the time, was that the law firm partner who, like, the where we actually took the deposition, used to be the DA of Hattiesburg, and he was the first DA to get Michael West on the witness stand and qualified as a bite mark expert. So there was like this really like very kind of cosmic symmetry to sitting there, you know, I mean, like, you know, 30, 40 years later from that first thing, and, you know, talking about innocent people that he put on death row.
So you were successful, obviously, but this was 26 years on death row for Mr. Howard. And I believe you've got great pictures in the book of some of the cases that either you, the Innocence Project, or you individually, I guess probably you, because you're in the pictures of cases you worked on and got them exonerated. That's not even a good word. They were released. And again, you know, what kind of life someone has after that, but they're free. Another well-known name to us cable news junkies is Nancy Grace. Tell us about Nancy Grace and Weldon Carr.
Oh, my God. Nancy Grace.
There you go. I think I struck a nerve. Tell us about Nancy Grace. Many people know. Tell us about her.
So Nancy Grace is still on cable television today, but, you know, maybe 10 years ago was a big star of headline news and really made her name by denigrating criminal defendants and, you know, trying them in the media and just lambasting them, you know, I mean, you know, somebody that, you know, has grown up and whose father was a public defender is like, you know, you're not going to appreciate Nancy Grace's perspective on the criminal legal system. But what I didn't know is how she got her start. And what Weldon Carr case in Atlanta, Georgia, was Nancy Grace's last jury trial when she had been a prosecutor there for a long time. And CNN was doing a profile of her called, you know, of the so-called pint-sized prosecutor who never lost a case, right? So, you know, that says something too about never losing a case, right? That means that you're, you know, going in there bare knuckle brawls on it. And, you know, the kind of formula that Nancy Grace has in cable television was also what she was doing in criminal courts, where you would have these Shakespearean themes that were playing out, you know, good and evil and money and sex and all of this. And so the Weldon Carr case, Mr. Carr was a wealthy seed merchant, apparently. So, like, you know, for flowers and plants or that kind of thing. Who knew you could make lots of money in that? But apparently he did. And he was having some marital difficulties, and a lot of wrongful convictions of spouses, you know, start with like people that were going through a divorce and then somebody or problems. And then, you know, one or the other ends up dead and the spouse is the first suspect. And that's usually, you know, there's a reason that you should look at the spouse. But what happened here is that Weldon Carr's wife was having an affair. He was recording her phone calls, which is, of course, very suspicious. One evening, right after one of these calls had been recorded with her lover, the house went up in flames. And he escaped through jumping out of a second-story window, fracturing a vertebrae in his back, and crawling next door and pounding on the door, saying that his wife was still inside the house. And that, you know, the fire trucks arrived, et cetera. And then, but it was too late. She had died. So all evidence pointed to a tragedy. Then somebody made a tip to the local authorities and said to check for arson. Then an arson investigator with the same folklore that we were talking about in the Cameron Todd Willingham case went into it and decided that this was arson. Nancy Grace, this is the perfect case for her to use as essentially an audition for a cable news show, right? And so she brought the case. But what really happened and what Nancy Grace buried was when they actually decided to chemically test the floorboards to see whether or not actually an accelerant had been used, right? So anything like lighter fluid or gasoline or something like that. And they thought that it was this boot polish that was flammable that had been used because they had found a can of that in the house. But when they did a chemical testing of the fire debris, that showed zero accelerants that were being used. And so that was buried. And what was used instead was a so-called accelerant sniffing dog who alerted, you know, to this. And then they hid the fact that the chemical test from the jury. And Mr. Carr was convicted. Ultimately, the case was argued in the Supreme Court of Georgia and overturned, and the court admonished Nancy Grace for prosecutorial misconduct, flagrant prosecutorial misconduct. She had hired her own investigator and then claimed with money out of her own pocket, and then claimed, you know, argued to the jury that they should believe him because he was an independent person. And, you know, wasn't hired by the state or the, you know, blah, blah. So, but she had personally hired him. And also that they conducted an experiment after the arrest of Mr. Carr, a smoke experiment in his house from his bedroom. They recorded an interview with her And it wasn't really to do an experiment. It was for CNN, you know, so Art Harris interviewed her in like this smoke-filled room while she was in a crime scene before the case had even been trialed. And then Weldon Carr had to see that from his prison cell, Nancy Grace in his bedroom doing this. And it was a wrongful conviction. So it was astonishing, you know, and then it was later, you know, another case where we finally learned, you know, how the scientific experiment that showed that all of this folklore was totally wrong. And what the arson investigators didn't really understand was full room involvement, or which will mimic all these signs, like the pore patterns and multiple points of origin, and crazed glass is not the product of excessive heat that happens in any normal fire. So all this was debunked and showed that, you know, these convictions were unreliable, you know, I mean, and that Nancy Grace was in the middle of it, which I didn't know before I had started the research on the book, was, you know, the perfect anchor for the chapters on arson investigation techniques and how it can be used, you know, in the hands of somebody that's as persuasive as Nancy Grace is.
Now, we've come almost to the end without getting wonky about numbers, but I think we need to. A little factoid I found in my reading was on hair analysis, that between 1970 and 1999, hair analysis on 268 cases proved through DNA later that 257 of them were wrong, and that's 96%. And you say, well, gee, that's awful. Yeah, well, what's more awful is in the same period, 9 people were executed where hair analysis was a big part of the case. So why don't you share with my listeners some numbers about, you know, innocent people, you know, going to jail or worse?
If you think that only 1% are innocent, you know, which I think is a conservative number, we're talking about tens of thousands of people.
Now, we should point out, as we close the podcast here, we should point out that it is a nonprofit organization. People can go to, it's very very easy, the Innocence Project, and there's a place where you, my audience, can donate funds to keep it alive. Obviously you guys are not making big bucks, the lawyers, you're dedicated to the project, but it costs money. And so, again, I do, tell people they should do that. Also, they should get the book, and they should, certainly, keep up with my, web page. I will certainly mention, when the paperback comes out, and it will have updates, but read the book first. Junk Science and the American Justice System by M. Chris Fabricant. And if nothing else, I hope this gives, my wife was called for jury duty the other day, but didn't get a case. But I hope, I've never been on a jury, but I hope that they will bring a healthy skepticism and beware of terms like
to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty.
To a reasonable degree of scientific certainty.
To a reasonable degree of scientific certainty.
Within a reasonable scientific certainty.
To a reasonable degree of scientific certainty.
Are you able to say that within a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
So anything you'd like to say in closing, Chris? It's the floor is yours.
No, I give you an amen, James. Be skeptical, and thanks so much for having me on.
So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.